Welcome to Heritage Radio Network On Tour. We are coming at you live. This is our opening show from Feast Portland. We are in the Heritage Radio Network podcast lounge presented by Le Creuset. If you are visiting the Big Feast today, Saturday, or tomorrow, Sunday, please come and sit with us in our lounge. It's beautiful. You can have some wine. You can have some snacks. It's starting to smell really, really good here. And as we are kicking things off, I want to say a huge thank you to our partners, Le Creuset, Travel Portland, Salt and Straw, and the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts for making our coverage possible. My name is Katie Mosman-Wadler. I'm the Executive Director of Heritage Radio Network. And today, to my left and right, we have some great friends of the network. We have Nate Collier from Le Creuset. Welcome.
Hello, hello. Welcome, everybody.
And we have the wonderful Gabby Dalkin.
Gabby.
I'm gonna get it right. Welcome. Gabby is a very accomplished author and familiar on Heritage Radio Network. You've heard her on several of our shows. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Happy feast.
Yeah, I'm ready. I didn't have breakfast. I'm like ready to roll.
You are prepared. How has your feast week been so far?
Great. I mean, we just got here last night and we did the cooking in color with Le Creuset, which was incredible. The persimmon color, which is up here. Gorgeous.
Super fun. Love hot pot.
Yeah. I mean, Nate and I sat next to each other and ate all the things and shared a piece of cake. So we really lived our best lives.
There was a mishap when they cut the cake and they cut one giant piece and asked if we might
share. It was
share
the size of our heads.
And we did. Like, it was delicious.
Huge. These things, like, good problems to have.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then they were like, you'll never finish it. And they came back and it was gone. And I was like, what do you expect?
What happened? Have you been to other events so far?
No, this is my first time at Feast, and last night was my first event.
All right, so you are ready.
Yeah, I'm ready to roll. I'm here all weekend.
We have been feasting our faces. I'm kind of in recovery, but I'm also like, am I hungry? We've been at East versus West Coast, and then last night we were at Night Market. And we've also been like going out for a lot of meals just in between because we're like, hey, we're in Portland and we have to go to all these restaurants. So we have been doing our exercises and we're ready to
You're eat walking.
More all day.
Where have you eaten?
Gosh, we had a really great lunch at Tasty and Alder the other day. And that is across the street and in the same restaurant group as Shalom, y'all.
The best.
And of course, we saw that and we were like, well, now we have to go over there. So then we had lunch at Shalom, y'all, which was delicious. They had this incredible special that was like a roasted peach with some salty goat cheese and hazelnuts and spicy honey.
Yum.
It's really good. Where else have we been?
Have you been to Tusk?
Have I been to Tusk? Not this trip.
Next.
But I have been.
Next.
Yeah,
next
wonderful.
Time. Okay.
Yeah. So it has been, so far, like, quick, lots of meals, jammed in. Also, like, at the after parties, like, we were at Saxon Wiener's last night, and Chris Cosentino was making these like insane hot dogs that had cheese and sauteed onions and something that was salty and crunchy that I couldn't figure out what it was until I finally like unwrapped the foil a little bit and realized that there were Fritos on this hot dog that was loaded with all this other stuff.
You guys, we have really terrible jobs.
Yeah.
I know.
It's really hard. So what's the hardest thing about being a food writer?
Oh my gosh. This sounds terrible, but I've been on like a bender the last week. I did like a charity golf tournament. I've just been eating. I don't remember what hunger feels like, which is truly terrible.
Yeah.
I love my job. I feel so lucky that I get to create recipes and meet people and go out for incredible meals. There's no downsides.
You have two cookbooks that you've authored and another one on the way, right?
Yes.
Can you tell us about the new book?
The third one?
Yeah.
Well, sure. I think so. I mean, I don't know. No one's told me not to. It comes out next spring, April 28th, to be exact. And the title is TBD, but it's pretty much going to be... I feel like this world revolves around, like, you're either keto or you're gluten-free or you're this or you're that. And I understand that if you have, like, actual food restrictions. But otherwise, I think people should just really eat what they want. And so the book is a celebration of that. And you can do it all and do it in balance. And there's everything from breakfast, lunch, and dinner to snacks to cocktails to dinner party menus, the whole nine yards, all within, you know, the What's Gotta Be Cooking California Girl umbrella.
I couldn't agree more with your philosophy on that, too. And I know it's a gray area because some people do need to stick to those things.
Sure.
But I feel like a lot of times people then turn eating into a non-enjoyable experience because they're worried about tracking everything
right.
or what they have. And And I don't like that. I like to enjoy what I eat, I wholeheartedly agree.
We should have permission to be able to do whatever we want and whatever makes you feel good. Right. Like, I think we all kind of do intuitive eating without thinking about it. Like, I think the word intuitive is sometimes a little scary to some people, but, like, you eat whatever is going to, you know, if you want pasta and you need carbs, you have some carbs. Right. Never say no to a hard carb.
Right.
I appreciate that. So What's Gotta Be Cooking is an appreciation of California cuisine. Do you think that there is sort of an old guard California cuisine and a new California cuisine, or has it been like, is there a morphology to what is becoming of California cuisine?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Alice Waters is just like the most incredible human on the planet, and she started what I associate with California cuisine, but I feel like the way I took it is more about, yes, you're eating fresh, you're eating what's in season, everything's colorful, but you're also, you know, just letting food shine. Like, I don't mess with a lot of ingredients. Like, we just got back from the farmer's market here at PSU, and like, if I had a flat of peaches in the car, which I do, like, I'm not gonna make them into like foam or anything like that. Like, I just want them to speak for themselves. So that, and also, like, I think in my world of California food, I don't take anything too seriously. So my recipes are easy, and you're never gonna be intimidated.
What would you do if you drove home with a flat of peaches right now?
I mean, I would make a peach caprese salad and then maybe like toss some into like a galette and then eat some raw. And maybe if some were going a little too soft, I'd make peach fruit leather.
Mm. Ooh, you know. Where can I find that recipe?
Fruit leather? Yeah. TBD, I haven't done it yet. It just came to my mind.
Because I love it.
I need a fruit dehydrator.
Nay, you're a cook too. What would you do with your flat of peaches?
I mean, this is it's not really a cop-out, but I was telling Gabi last night at dinner, my grandparents lived in Salem, Oregon, 45-ish minutes south of here. We would come every summer, and the first time I ever had real peaches was from a roadside stand in Oregon, in this area. And my grandmother just sliced them and put fresh, cold whole cream on top of them. And I'd probably sprinkle a little bit of salt on top of it now, but like not knowing what that would do with it back then, I still have a very vivid memory of that. And like Gabi said, if they were great peaches, you don't need to do too much with them. And that's okay. I want people to feel comfortable that they don't have to dress it up.
Do you travel with your own little tin of Maldon sea salt?
I don't, but I do have some of those little tins at home.
We should both start that.
My sister and I have been working on our kind of like purse condiments kits.
Yeah.
Do you have one?
Our what kits?
Like purse condiments, like the Maldon tins, hot sauce, like what's in your kit?
I don't, but if I were to put one together, it would be Maldon sea salt, Sir Kensington's ketchup, and like that's probably it. Like those are the two most important things in my life.
Yeah.
What would be in yours?
Definitely the salt.
Yeah.
Also Jacobson. We have to give a shout out to the local amazing salt people. They have an adorable tin too. So that's actually what is in my purse is
chocolate.
The Jacobson tin.
Mean chocolate too.
Oh yeah, a purse chocolate. Yeah, that goes without saying. That's separate from the accoutrement. That's its own category. I have some in my bag right now that I picked up at the Hoxton. I just like saw a bowl of chocolate bars
in case of emergency.
Yeah,
right.
It is very important to have this around.
So for sure, salt, probably some Spanish olive oil, and either Aleppo or Espalette pepper, those three. And this is so funny.
So you're basically cooking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those things I could never live without, but I don't want to digress and get into it, but this is so funny. I've had a conversation with people on two different occasions of a party game of, if your fingers were condiment guns, what five things would you have, and those were the only ones you could have for the rest of your life?
That's a great game.
What would they be? And there's a full spectrum of answers and then side arguments on what actually constitute a condiment versus a garnish or something
else.
That's
a better game than
play that game at home, everybody. It's fun.
Yeah. We are 100% playing this after the show.
Yeah, and that's better than playing who would you have dinner with, dead or alive. Right. Like, that's way more complicated. Yeah. It's harder. Yeah.
This is so exciting. Okay, I can't wait. Party games after this. I want to talk about color because California cuisine is all about fresh ingredients and beautiful, colorful ingredients. And I also think Le Creuset is absolutely all about color. And Gabi, I'll start with you and just ask, you know, as you're thinking about composing recipes for your blog or for books, how are you thinking about colors in sort of the recipes coming together?
Yeah, it's a huge part of it, actually. It's really interesting. If you look at my website, you'll very rarely see something that's all brown. Like, if I'm going to do a grilled piece of meat, there's going to be some sort of salsa verde or like a chopped fruit salsa or something on top, just because from a visual perspective, you want it to be colorful. A, that's going to perform really well on Instagram. B, that's how we all eat with our eyes. And also, we think about color when we're propping everything out. Like, I work with a team. Matt Armendariz is my food photographer, and Adam Pearson's my food stylist. We have, like, all the La Crusade at the studio, and other than, like, napkins and all these different things, and you want to bring complementary colors into the photo to make it really appealing, because people have so many options of what to make, they're going to pick what looks the prettiest. Yeah. You know? So color is a huge part of my world.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. People, you know, eat with their eyes first. That's not just a saying. It's absolutely the, you know, first thing that your first thought process is going to come from what the food looks like. So not only does it have to look appetizing from a texture standpoint, but the color plays a huge role in that.
Yeah.
And not necessarily to mean, like, plating so perfectly to take away from what the dish actually is. And I think your food style doesn't do that at all. I think it's right on. But
messy.
I think it's not about, like, you know, creating a masterpiece or a palette. It's being true to what the food is and what people think it should taste like. And then, of course, what it says about you. And so, you know, if you look at different people's, we're obviously a very visual culture now, look at people's different feeds, you can recognize people's style and pick it out. And I'm sure you feel the same way. You have your own style. And it says something about them. And same with the cookware. You know, not only do we have really beautiful colors, but we have enough for people to pick something that says something about them and they have a relationship with it. So it's hugely important.
Yeah. And thinking about, you know, sort of coming at food from a visual perspective has been a big part of your career. Can you talk about, you're a culinary school graduate. Can mm-hmm. you talk a little bit about how you kind of emerged from culinary school? What was your path to food writing?
Yeah, so I went to culinary school just out of college, really on a whim. I was doing it to avoid getting another job. I had no intention of going into the food world afterwards, but I started my blog and I started working as a private chef during culinary school. And so when I finished and graduated, I just stayed. Like, I stayed working as a private chef, which was the income, and I started, and What's Gotta Be Cooking was chugging along, making 12 cents a day. So, like, that was just for fun.
Just rolling in.
My mom, who's here, was the only person that commented on my site for, like, years. and so it was, What's Gotta Be Cooking just slow rolled for eight or 9 years ago. And it morphed. I quit personal chefing eventually, and it morphed into, like, one cookbook and then two cookbooks, and I started working with brands on different collaborations. I have a line of products sold at Williams-Sonoma. You know, like, I write food guides to cities. Like, I wouldn't say, like, I'm a classic food writer. Like, I'm not writing for the Times or anything like that, but I feel like I'm making food accessible for my audience and bringing them into my world and giving and, like, letting them not be intimidated by the kitchen.
Yeah.
Did that answer the question?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. And the role of the classic food writer is changing.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
You know, some would say maybe going away a little bit, and there's a lot more of the sort of hustling across, like, many different types of media and looking at, you know, food writing is now not just about writing memoirs and essays. That's still important and it's still, you know,
right.
being done really well. But there are so many other forms of content sort of that are
right.
Necessary now to kind of make a living in the field.
Yeah, and it changes all the time. Like mm-hmm. For What's Gotta Be Cooking, we used to do a weekly Snapchat show on Fridays at noon when Snapchat was still a thing. And then when IG Stories and IG Live came out, my audience was vastly bigger over there. So I switched over, and now we do, like, a live cooking show every Monday night at 6 p.m. And it's like there's you're just always creating content, whether that's in visual, video, writing, whatever it is. It's an ever-changing job.
Yeah. So as podcasters, we are often sitting behind a microphone, and unlike today when we actually are, you know, have an audience that we can see, we are putting everything out online. You don't necessarily see who you're interacting with, but you are so active on social media. How important is it to you to sort of know and get feedback from your audience, and how much do you feel like you kind of know who's on the receiving end of the content?
It's A, it's so important. Like, it's a huge part of my job. Also, it's my most favorite part of my job to speak to everyone. I respond to every single DM that I get. I get to meet people at events like Feast or at dinner at the Cooking in Color last night, dinner. I mixed up those words, but you get what I meant. Like, it's so important. I can tell you exactly who my audience is. I'm either your friend, your daughter, or your granddaughter, and I can tell you how, like, I can tell you people's spending habits. It's very interesting, and it's something I care a lot about because it's really helpful when we're figuring out what to call a book, what product to come out with next, what brands to partner with. Those are all things that play into those decisions.
Yeah. So I have a question about that, too, that I was thinking about, and I think... it's awesome. I mean, because we do that as a brand too. I mean, you want to interact with the people that want to interact with you, and it's authentic. And I think you've created this really authentic relationship by being true to who you are. But specifically from like a recipe side, all of the feedback that you get on your recipes of what worked and didn't work, how much of that influences you when you're like, for say, writing your third book? Did you take a different approach? How consciously do you think about what they're going to say about your recipes?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. So the most popular recipe for my last book was the chicken lard bowl, which was just like a sleeper hit. I had no idea it would be so popular. And so because of that, and because I saw so many people making it on their Instagrams and social media for the last year and a half, we did a whole new section in this book that's all very much bowl and kind of international influenced food. And then I forgot what the second part I was going to say to that question, but...
No, I mean, it makes sense to me. I just, I wonder how you balance, you know, your voice versus, you know, conforming to the feedback of the crowd, so to speak.
It's interesting. I mean, there's one of my top fans on Facebook currently hates chicken, and she comments on everything I post with chicken, and she's like, if you post one more chicken recipe, I'm leaving. She's probably listening. Hi, Marie. But I also know that chicken's going to perform really well, like, and people love it, and there are all these moms that are trying to get dinner on the table. We also test all my recipes 4 or 5 times before anything goes live with me and my recipe tester, so I know I'm not going to get a lot of bad feedback, so I can avoid that. It's mostly like, we need more meals under 20 minutes or stuff like that.
You're sort of maybe speaking to my next question, and maybe there isn't one, but what have you had a really controversial recipe that surprised you?
Mom? A really controversial recipe that surprised me. My mom pays really close attention to these things. I thought maybe she would know. No, like nothing bad. Like I haven't had any like real mishaps or anything. Yeah. I have a recipe called Slutty Brownies on my website, which is like kind of controversial just because of the name. So people like name it other things when they're making for their 5-year-old kids because they're not trying for
Are those the grandmothers and not the friends of
your
group?
Yeah, it's the moms and the grandmas. And they're like, we call them naughty brownies. Right. I'm like, you do you. Full support.
Whatever you want. They're delicious brownies. You've got some praise hands from mom in the back.
What about it? Oh, my mom's cucumber salad was in the cookbook, and it's literally the easiest recipe in the entire world. It's like cucumbers, avocados, and a balsamic vinaigrette, and hundreds, if not thousands, of people have made it. So, also not controversial, but very surprising.
That's amazing. Do you have, like, traditional, or sort of traditional to your family recipes?
Yeah,
I try. That you kind of publish without modification?
Definitely in the books. Like, I try and dedicate a recipe in the book to everyone in my family. Like, I have something from my Omi and my Papa, my mom, my grandma, my dad, Matt and Adam, my photographers. Thomas, this is a secret, I shouldn't say this, but my husband has a whole chapter in this next book. It's called So Easy Thomas Can Do It. Because one time, Thomas started his own Instagram account called What's Thomas Eating to make fun of me. And he made scrambled eggs in the microwave once, and people were appalled, including me.
Like, did they blow up?
No, but one of my girlfriends texting me, she's like, 911, like, go home. Like, things are bad. Like, things are dark in your kitchen. And so I don't remember where I was going with that, but...
But they're so easy that Thomas
can make. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Even Thomas can make these recipes.
Wow. I look forward to that. That's pretty exciting. I have a husband who doesn't cook really much.
Well, and Thomas can teach him to make scrambled eggs now. That's one thing
he can do
knows.
It in the microwave, he probably will. people must go to you a lot for advice on becoming a food blogger or a food writer.
Yes.
Does this happen all the time?
All the time. I can tell you every single one of... like most acquaintances from high school have now tried to start a food or fashion blog in some sense and quit with very quickly afterwards.
What are the top reasons that they quit?
Well, I think people look at food blogging and think, A, oh, you make decent money and it looks like so much fun. You're out like doing all these cool things. You get to work with amazing brands. But I don't think they realize how much work actually goes into it, and that I haven't taken it. Most people haven't taken it. I mean, I personally haven't taken a day off in like 7 years. We were in Patagonia earlier this year with my family and we were like hiking some crazy 8-hour hike, and I was emailing Margo from William Sonoma about something I need, like whatever. Like I just, you don't stop, you don't turn off, you don't have people working for you, so you're always on.
Right.
So that's probably the biggest reason people quit, is because of the time commitment. And it's also not an overnight thing. It took me probably 6 years for What's Gobby Cooking to churn enough of an income to walk away from private chefing and feel not terrified to go to bed every night that I wasn't going to have any money in my bank account the next day.
Do you think people should talk more about those terrified feelings that they feel?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's any business, right? When you start, nothing's going to be a success overnight. But food blogging, especially when you're not with a team and you don't have all these other, you know, support groups around you, it's a little harder, I think.
Mm-hmm. Have you had mentors in the space for yourself?
I don't know if I've had mentors in this space. Ree from the Pioneer Woman's been like an incredible role model to me, but I've surrounded myself with a really incredible team, like Matt, my food photographer, and Adam, my food stylist, and my whole family at Williams Sonoma. Like, we have such a like great synergy about us. It's been really helpful when you're growing a business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you give advice for kind of fledgling food bloggers?
Yeah.
What are your like top advice pieces that you give out?
Don't start it for the money, because that will take you a really long time. Mm-hmm. And B, figure out what your voice is. Like for the first couple years of What's Gobby Cooking, I couldn't tell you what my brand was because I was just figuring it out. And that's okay, but eventually you have to figure out who you are and what you stand for, and make your, like, you're the only person who can tell your story. So figure it out, figure out what you want to say, and then do it. So those are my top two pieces of advice.
Thank you.
And take photos in natural light. That's no artificial
like outside,
lighting.
Go outside.
Yeah, or like by a window.
Okay.
You don't want any artificial lighting if you can avoid it.
Okay.
And taste your food.
Yeah, true. Make sure your recipes work.
100%.
Nobody has to remind me to eat the food while I'm cooking.
Same.
It. But yeah, I think it's like, taste it and leave enough that you can plate it on the plate after. Make extra to taste. Do you do a lot of iPhone photography?
iPhone?
Do you give tips on iPhone photography?
So I don't shoot a lot of my own photos in studio anymore because I have my team, but I do when I'm out in the field. Like last night I was shooting my own photography, and so my biggest tips are, A, when in doubt, go overhead. B, find a great window and like use as much natural light as possible. And C, try and, you know, move around and find the prettiest dish or prettiest angle or something, like find something that's colorful. Last night was great because everything was in the persimmon Le Creuset, so it was like you couldn't take a bad picture if you tried. So
that kind of leads me into something I wanted to ask both of you about, because it is getting to be coming into holiday season. Your new book is not going to be out quite yet, but there are some beautiful Le Creuset colors. Are there some Le Creuset items that you would recommend for holiday gifting? And also, you know, for people who are getting into food Instagrams or food blogging, like some styling pieces that you would really recommend?
Nate, you go first.
Everything. No, I mean, I think you have to be, especially if you're doing it for photography, conscious of scale. And so we offer lots of smaller things that are easier to get in photos and style. But, know what your setting is. We have a lot of colors that can match to your kitchen and your style. And like Gobby said, too, I mean, it's about your, if you are doing it for pictures to represent yourself, you want it to fit your style and express your personal style. So just make sure you're sticking true to that. But I mean, round Dutch oven, you can't go wrong with. Little mini cocottes with pops of color, you can't go wrong with. Lot of things in there to work with.
I love this idea of scale and, you know, maybe not starting your collection with a bunch of enormous items that are going to take a ton of food to fill that you might not be cooking in that volume when you're cooking at home for yourself or your sort of small family. Gabby, what would be some, Gabby, what would be some of yours? Sorry.
I agree with Nate. Even the small Dutch ovens feed a lot of people.
Totally.
Like, you couldn't serve, like, probably a family of 6 to 8 in a small Dutch oven of soup or chili or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love all of it. I'm trying to pick a favorite. Oh, the round braisers.
Yeah.
Those are clutch for the holidays, because you can do, like, you could do a chili in it, you could do some sort of, I'm trying to look and talk at the same time, it's a problem.
And last night, too, we had the lid flipped over, balancing on the knob with the raw ingredients to go into the hot pot.
Cool.
It was just a really cool setup. You can get creative out there.
Yeah.
We baked a pot pie crust on an inverted lid on top of the Dutch oven in the oven at the same time, so it didn't get soggy sitting on top of the filling.
So then you kind of flip it over.
You do have to take it out of the oven, take the upside down lid off of the oven itself, but then you just slide the crispy crust right on top, and
that is
it's
brilliant.
Not soggy.
Mm-hmm.
Have fun. That's basically where I'm going with it. Have fun and do what you want. Don't worry too much about what other people are going to think about it.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about this before, but like all one color, mix of colors, you do you.
What's your kitchen, Nate?
Everything.
All of it.
Everything. When we first started, it was a lot of blue, and then everything else came in. We were talking about it last night. If I started over, I would probably go with a neutral oyster, or love the Williams-Sonoma French gray too. And lots of pops of color around that.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, don't be afraid to mix it up and match it up a little bit.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we are just about out of time for our first segment. I want to say a huge thank you to Nate Collier and Gabby Dalkin for joining us today on Heritage Radio Network on Tour.
Thanks for
having us.
Awesome.
Thanks, Katie. This was fun.
Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your feast weekend. We are just at the very beginnings here, so a lot of things
game time
to eat and drink. We are going to be here both days, all day, live broadcasting. Huge thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network on Tour, presented by Le Creuset. Thanks again to our additional supporters, Travel Portland, Salt and Straw, and the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts, for making our coverage possible. We'll be back soon after a short break.